From Today Ticks and Theater People, this is Broadway Backstory, the podcast that finds out how a show develops from an idea to a full Broadway production. I'm your host, Patrick Hines. This week, we're covering Come From Away. We'll find out how the show developed from a community's altruistic response to tragedy to a musical celebration of kindness and compassion that broke through in one of Broadway's most competitive seasons and became one of the most celebrated and successful shows of our time. The story of Come From Away centers around two groups of people. First being the residents of Gander, a town described in the musical as being on the northeast tip of North America on an island called Newfoundland. The second group being the crew and passengers of 38 airplanes that were forced to land in Gander on September 11, 2001, after the terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., and the plane that had crashed in Pennsylvania. Before we get to the making of the beautiful musical that came out of how these lives intersected on that day and the days that followed, let's start by explaining what happened there and why it was so extraordinary that a musical just begged to be written about it.
Good day.
How are you, sir?
I'm great.
Thank you so much.
This is Claude Elliott. He's the mayor of Gander, Newfoundland today, and was on the morning of September 11th, 2001. He's also a character in the musical. I asked him if we could start with him telling me a little bit about Gander and how 28 airplanes were diverted there on that terrible morning.
Well, Gander is a town. It's sort of centered in the center of the island off Newfoundland. We are a airport town and a government town. We have a huge airport here, as Gander was built on aviation. And we have a population now of over 13,000 people. The unemployment rate is very low in Gander by the standards of Newfoundland. We're probably around 4% unemployment. So it's most everybody in the town here is working.
One of the most important things to know about Gander, at least for the purposes of this story, is the history and significance of its airport. As the mayor explained it to me, Gander was actually founded in 1936 so the American military could build an airport there.
The American military started Gander. During the Second World War, they were looking for a place to ferry their planes across the ocean, and they had to find a place to refuel, and Gander was what they selected. Because they could stop, refuel, and go on across the ocean. And we have a huge airport here. At one time, we had the largest airport in the world.
The airport's location and size were critical in making Gander a hub for the emergency landings that happened on the morning of September 11th, 2001. At 9:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time that morning, American airspace was closed to all international flights, causing about 500 flights that were already in the air to be turned back or redirected to other countries. 226 of those flights would be diverted to Canada. Gander is 2 hours ahead of New York, so it was 11:45 a.m. Gander time when Mayor Claude Elliott got the news. Just a heads up, the mayor mentions the coffee shop Tim Hortons here, just like his character does in the musical, and I want you to know that I did a silent squeal when that happened.
I was ready to leave Tim Hortons when I got a call from the town manager at the time, telling me that there was a terrorist attack on New York and throughout the states, and that the planes were being told to land at the nearest airport as quickly as possible. And we realized then that we were going to get some airplanes, because once traffic leaves Europe in the morning, once it gets over halfway across, the nearest airport is Gander, because we're the crossroads of the world. We were told to expect 200 aircraft. But I guess fortunately that the ones that weren't halfway across was told to turn back, and the ones that didn't landed at Gander, we ended up with 38 aircraft and about 7,000 people.
So that was the perspective on the ground on that scary and confusing morning in Gander. In the sky over the Atlantic, it was a similar sort of controlled chaos. Captain Beverly Bass, who you'll get to know well over the course of this episode, was a pilot for American Airlines and was 7 hours into a flight from Paris to Dallas when the American airspace was closed.
I had just left Paris en route to Dallas, and I was right over the middle of the North Atlantic, and we have what is called an air-to-air frequency that all airplanes must monitor when you're over international waters because, you know, we're not really in contact with any radar facility. So it gives us the ability to communicate with each other. For the most part, you don't hear anything on the frequency. That day, somebody came on the frequency and said that an airplane had hit the World Trade Center. And, you know, my co-pilot and I are just sitting there talking like we would on a normal day. And so, you know, we just assumed it was a light airplane, like I think many people did in the beginning. And then we waited about 20 minutes later, and we heard the second tower had been hit. And with that came the word terrorism. We then heard that New York's airspace was closed, then all of the U.S. airspace was closed. And that was our clue to start planning a divert into one of the Canadian airports. And so, of course, we start programming our computers with Toronto, Montreal, Edmonton, Calgary, and, you know, because we had to make sure we had enough fuel, which we did, to go to any of those cities. And never dreaming that, A, we would be ordered to land, and B, that it would be in a town as remote as Gander. So when we approach 50 degrees west longitude, which is when you come in contact with Gander radar control, we received our orders to land immediately in Gander, Newfoundland.
As Captain Bass explained it to me, she and her crew were sort of on their own in terms of protocol and how to handle a plane full of confused and worried passengers who wouldn't find out what had happened in New York and Washington, D.C. until the planes landed.
We had received a report through our communication lines that what would appear to be maybe a terrorist activity or hijacking has occurred.
We had never been trained for what had happened. We didn't have an operating manual. We didn't have a checklist. So we literally just kind of moved hour by hour waiting for instructions. We didn't know if we were going to spend the night and depart the next morning. We really did not know much of anything.
On the ground, the mayor knew that it would likely be days before these planes would be taking off again, and that his town needed to begin immediate preparations to host the nearly 7,000 people who'd be getting off these 38 planes over the course of the day.
The first thing I did as mayor was declare a state of emergency, and they declared that so as we could get access to the hotel rooms. We only have 500 hotel rooms here in Gander, and we needed them for the crew. We needed somewhere for them to go and get their proper rest and sleep for when they would be ready to fly back out. And it was at that time that we contacted the Salvation Army and the Red Cross and told them to go to the airport because we heard that they were running out of food, running out of water on aboard the airplanes. So we sent over 400 volunteers up there, and they made up 7,000 lunchboxes. So when people come off the plane, when they came in through customs, they were greeted with a volunteer who had a lunchbox which consisted of a juice, a fruit, a sandwich, and a water, and they were given that. Plus, they were given a hug because at that time we felt that they needed probably more of a hug than they needed food.
I don't know if you can hear it, but I make an audible gasp in there when the mayor said that the passengers were greeted with a lunchbox and a hug. Maybe it's the, let's call them difficult political times we're living in, but the idea of an elected official recognizing the value of a hug. Whew. The hug is just the tip of the iceberg of the kindness and hospitality these 7,000 foreigners received from the people of Gander over the 4 days they spent there. Striking bus drivers came off the picket lines to transport people into Gander and the neighboring towns.
And we all came back and we did our job.
We'll do the best we can. Look after this. If there's anything you need, anything at all, I mean anything, just ask. And you will be taken care of, bottom line. Okay? Make it as comfortable as possible.
Local meeting halls, schools, and churches were converted into comfortable shelters run by citizen volunteers 24 hours a day. Then, of course, are the stories of the hundreds, maybe thousands of local families that took some of these strangers, these come-from-aways, as anyone who isn't from there is called, into their homes, no questions asked.
You have to come and stand over here, so you'll be famous in the States now.
Yeah. Yes.
In fact, the local citizens and the come-from-aways grew so close over the few days they all spent together that Mayor Claude Elliott describes it like this.
I tell people what happened was on the first day, there were 7,000 strangers landed in Gander. About the third day, there were 7,000 friends we had. And by the time they left on the 5 days, we were losing 7,000 family members. That's how close we became to the passengers. They were in our homes. We took them in and let them get showers and let them sleep and, you know, and we let them use our phones to call people and that. So it was a family thing. It's like we understood the tragedy that the Americans were going through. And as I said, as much as they needed food, they also needed love and compassion. And that's what we provided. We did that. And, you know, when we see the smiles on people's faces when they left and the tears of joy, we were paid in full. We didn't need nothing else. Our job had done, and we sent away 7,000 people very happy during a very difficult time in their life.
About 1,500 miles away, in New York City, a young Canadian couple named Irene Sankoff and David Hine, and spoiler alert for anyone who doesn't know, they go on to write Come From Away a decade later, were shaken by 9/11. David actually had a cousin working in one of the Twin Towers that day, who thankfully got out. The couple had been living in New York City for Irene's graduate studies, but that was wrapping up and they were getting ready to head back to Canada. And with all of the change in the air for them, the events of 9/11 inspired them to take a major step before they left. The cousin they refer to here is the same cousin who'd escaped the Twin Towers on 9/11.
There's a whole seize the day mentality right after 9/11. We were already engaged, and one day we woke up and I said, let's just go get married. And so we went and eloped at City Hall, and we asked my cousin to come and be our witness, and she came with us, and it was this amazing, it was a wonderful ceremony that was just for us. And
but then, not thinking that none of us had been downtown, and she hadn't been downtown in particular, so she got there and she was a little bit white, and she was like, no, I'm okay, I'm glad to be here, and let's do, you know, and we did the wedding, and it was wonderful and beautiful ceremony. And then she was like, I just need to walk back, just need to trace my steps, like what, how I left. And so we walked back with her and just looked at, you know, the store is still covered in dust, and, you know, written heroes live forever on the windows in the dust, and then eventually went and had, you know, a nice dinner. You know, it was sort of with mixed feelings, like we were, you know, the wedding, it was.
But it really was, you know, it was a celebration of love with this really strange backdrop.
I don't think it can be overstated how important that experience, their wedding in New York City just a few weeks after 9/11, was to priming them to be the perfect team to write Come From Away a few years later. It was, as David said, a celebration of love with a really strange backdrop, which perfectly describes the plot of Come From Away. So here's how they got there. In the early 2000s, Irene and David moved back to Toronto, where they worked day jobs, while Irene pursued a career as an actress and David as a musician. And then, around 2009, David had a realization which manifested itself in the form of a musical called My Mother's Lesbian Jewish Wiccan Wedding.
My mother's lesbian Jewish Wiccan wedding was nice. Not your typical wedding, it was out on a field and nobody threw rice. I held the hooker and it was pretty good, and you should have seen my Uncle Larry get a look at my mother's lesbian Jewish Wiccan wedding was great.
I was a singer-songwriter, Irene's an actress, and between day jobs and night jobs, we never saw each other, so we decided that we would do a Fringe Festival show together. We'd write a musical so we could actually just hang out, because we were always too busy. And I had written a song called My Mother's Lesbian Jewish Wiccan Wedding, which is about my mom. And so we got a spot, and we wrote a full script. And then one of Irene's friends said that she was so excited about it because it was a true story, and it was about our family, and We looked
I came running back and I was like, we got to throw the whole thing out. It's got to be a true story. What are we thinking? Like,
because it was all,
it wasn't.
It was all fictionalized.
It was just mix up mayhem and an actual gay wedding.
So we threw it out and we wrote it all again just from our family's true stories, which we'd always just thought, you know, these are just stories about our family, but everyone was like, no, that's really weird.
My mother's lesbian Jewish Wiccan wedding was a huge hit at the Toronto Fringe.
My mom recently married her partner Jane, and my mom is Jewish, and Jane is Wiccan, so they had a lesbian Jewish Wiccan wedding. And we made a musical about it.
And was picked up by commercial producer David Mervish for a commercial run. One of the people who saw the commercial run was Michael Rubinoff, a Toronto lawyer, theater producer, and associate dean at Sheridan College. Michael had long thought that the story of Gander on 9/11 should be musicalized.
I was really moved by this story when I read about it in the aftermath of the events. And as a theater producer who develops musicals, I felt it was a really compelling story. And I felt musicalizing it was compelling because music is such a part of the DNA of Newfoundlanders. It's how they tell their stories. And I thought it was a story that needed to be shared.
Farewell to all you pretty ladies waving from the dock. Heave away, me Johnny's heave away. And if we do return to you... We'll
after seeing my mother's lesbian Jewish Wiccan wedding, Michael thought that David and Irene would be a good fit to write the show about Gander. And the timing was spot on, because it was right around this time that the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks was approaching. A lot of the Come From Aways who had been stranded in Gander on 9/11 would be returning for the anniversary, which meant that David and Irene could go there to interview the people and get firsthand accounts from the people who had lived it. Here's Mayor Claude Elliott on preparing for the 10th anniversary, and then Captain Beverly Bass. Captain Bass mentions Nick and Diane, a couple who met while stranded in Gander and went on to get married.
You know, on the 10th anniversary, we wanted to pay tribute to the men and women who lost their lives, in that tragedy in New York, in the Pentagon, and in Pennsylvania, but we also celebrated the friendships that we made. Those people came back for the 10th anniversary. There was reunions and that. So, we did it in celebration to let terrorism know that you're not going to win this war. You might win some battles, but you're not going to win the war. So it was twofold.
We actually had no plans to even go back. We didn't know anything was being done in Gander. And I received a phone call from an Austrian film crew who were going there to film Nick and Diane. And he asked me if I was going back. And I said, well, no, I never even thought about it. I didn't know anything about it. And he said, well, would you consider going back? So I talked to my husband. He said, yeah, I'd love to go. So we made plans immediately to go. And I just thought I was going to show my husband the Comfort Inn and Jungle Jim's restaurant where I ate every single meal for 5 days. It was connected to the Comfort Inn. And we got there, and every minute of our 4 days was booked solid with constant entertainment and events. And oh my gosh, it was just fabulous.
With grant money from the Canadian Council for the Arts, David and Irene set off for Gander. Not exactly sure who they wanted to talk to, how they were going to arrange interviews, or how exactly they were going to record those interviews, they just hit the ground running.
The town was filled with press looking for all these like little sound clips, and we didn't know what we were looking for. We didn't even know how to record. We were like frantically writing down notes initially, and then we were like, do our iPhones, do these things record? How do these? And we ended up interviewing people for hours and then getting invited back to their houses and getting screeched in and making friends in the same way that the people in Newfoundland made friends with these strangers off the plains.
One of the first people they interviewed was Mayor Claude Elliott, who, even now, sort of can't understand why anything that happened in Gander on September 11th, 2001, should be seen as extraordinary. So when David and Irene told him that they were writing a musical about it...
I thought they were crazy. I didn't know how they could take this and turn it into a musical. I we look out for each other, in a time of need. People rally around and just get out and make sure that everybody is not hungry, make sure that if you got something to eat, you make sure your neighbor's got something. So, no, it's just been passed down from generation to generation. Here in Newfoundland, it's just something we do is helping each other. And, you know, when they said they were going to make a musical out of what happened in Gander, all I said was, well, I wish you well and good luck.
Another person they interviewed at length on that trip was Captain Beverly Bass. They did their first interview with her in the lobby of the Comfort Inn, where Captain Bass had sort of sequestered herself on September 11th, 2001.
And she showed us like everything that was different, everything that had changed, and said, you know, I never left except for when I went to the restaurant or to talk to my passengers. And this was my command station. I just had the door open and people would come and go.
And she told us her whole life story. We just kept asking. And I think she expected us to be like, you know, 10 minutes. And she gave us hours. And
at one point she was like, what's this for? And we're like, oh, we're doing, you know, we're going to do a musical. And we're...
First of all, they look like young kids to me. I don't even know what a playwright is. I don't have any idea what it's like to write a story and then for it to go to Broadway, even though I know that wasn't their first intent. You know, they were just in Gander to see if there was a story to be told. But I had no idea. And of course, the rest is history, and it couldn't be a more beautiful story, I don't think.
By the time David and Irene left Gander, they'd collected nearly 500 pages worth of interviews, which was a mind-boggling amount of source material. And though they'd been commissioned to write a musical, Irene was starting to wonder if that form would serve the material best. In order to understand how David and Irene figured out how they were going to tell the story of Come From Away, you need to understand a few things. First, you need to know what a kitchen party is. Here's David.
It's in the DNA of the people out there, right? They just got 7 feet of snow a little while ago, and it's how you get through there. You're like literally trapped in your house, and you dig enough to get through to your friend's kitchen where you can have a kitchen party, and everyone brings over, you know, a fiddle, an accordion, and a guitar, and they sing songs, and they play instruments, and they tell stories, and they stay alive by being a community and by supporting each other and by staying warm.
Next, you need to understand David and Irene's influences. First, the Laramie Project, which was one of the first of its kind of pieces of documentary theater. Written by Moises Kaufman and the Tectonic Theater Project in 1998 in response to the murder of a young gay man named Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming. Basically, the Tectonic Theater Project went to Laramie in the weeks after the murder, interviewed the townspeople there, and turned those interviews into a play. Lastly, the play 6 Degrees of Separation by John Guare, which expertly breaks the theater's fourth wall, which means that the characters sometimes talk directly to the audience, making them part of the world of the play. Here's Irene and David on figuring out what their show should be.
We were commissioned to write a musical, but like with most things in my life, for a second, I was like, I really doubted. I was like, maybe it shouldn't be a musical. Maybe it's Laramie Project. It's a town's reaction to a tragedy. It's how a town responds, and that's what Laramie is. And you know, and I just, and 6 Degrees of Separation really sort of informed the way we wanted to shape the show. So I was, so I had all of these plays in my head that instead of musicals that were informing me. So I was like, okay, let's just for a second put the art first and see what the best medium is.
But I'd grown up on Newfoundland music. For some reason, I'd grown up in Saskatchewan, but they'd all toured through there and I knew all of this music, and it's this insanely wonderful Celtic-infused authentic music that you never heard in musical theater before, and I really wanted to play in that sandbox, but it wasn't. But we like argued back and forth about it until September 10th, 2011. There was a kitchen party benefit concert in the hockey ice rink in Gander, and this band called the Navigators came out, and everyone started dancing. The locals that Come From Away's, us, there were executives from the airlines, from Lufthansa, in their three-piece suits, and they were all swinging each other around. And Irene was like, okay, you're totally right.
It has to be a musical because that music, oh my God.
That's what we wanted to do on stage. We wanted to bring the audience into a kitchen party and tell the story of what happened there.
So with the what figured out, they next needed to figure out the how. How were they going to sift through these 500 pages of interviews to find the musical within them?
There really were so many stories. There's 7,000 people on the plane, so there's 9,000 people in the town, and we were trying to do a 100-minute musical with 12 actors. So we went up to a cabin, we spread every sheet of paper we had, and we had letters that we got to photocopy from the library, from all the schools people had written back. We had documentaries to watch and books and articles, everything we could find. What we tried to do was find characters that sort of started at the beginning and went all the way to the 10th anniversary. We called those our spine characters. And then we also, began to group anecdotes about food or anecdotes about love or anecdotes about religion or faith or loss or
animals,
try to find
children,
themes. And then we could string these smaller stories along all the way along. But we just couldn't represent everyone, so we needed to combine them together. But what we really wanted to do was have everyone who we interviewed sit in the audience and say, "You got it right. That was my experience."
The very first workshop, a 45-minute presentation of the show, was produced in 2012 by Michael Rubinoff for the Canadian Music Theater Project. Rubinoff, you might remember, had also been the person who'd suggested the idea of the musical to David and Irene in the first place. Rubinoff had created the Canadian Music Theater Project at Sheridan College as an incubator for new musicals. Come From Away, cast with students from the college, was one of the first shows they did. That original 45-minute workshop was so successful that Rubinoff invited David and Irene to complete the work, and a full two-act version was presented in 2013 as part of Sheridan College's regular theatrical season. After the break, Come From Away attracts fancy New York producers, finds a Broadway director, and does four out-of-town tryouts before heading back to Gander and then on to Broadway.
I'm Kimmy, and I'm an acting student and YouTuber from London. Theatre means life for me, because it's like the way you breathe. It's something you can't stop. I can't stop thinking about. Acting is something I can't switch off. So for me, yeah, it's like breathing for me. It's like how an Olympic swimmer just thinks about swimming and they practice their craft and they do it 24/7. That's theatre for me.
Today Tix believes that theatre is for everyone. Whether you're a regular or a first-timer, we'll help you see theatre differently. Download the app, that's Today, T-I-X, or visit todaytix.com to see what's playing near you.
Around the time David and Irene were getting that first workshop of Come From Away off the ground at Sheridan College, they had a breakfast meeting with producers Randy Adams and Sue Frost of Junkyard Dog Productions, the production team behind the Tony-winning musical Memphis, as well as First Date and Dr. Zhivago. David and Irene had mutual friends with Randy and Sue, so the breakfast meeting was more of a favor, an advice-giving session to the young writers. And when they told Randy and Sue what Come From Away was about, their reaction was,
"You're doing what? A musical about 9/11? Sure, okay, good luck with that."
Yeah, good luck with that.
But as fate would have it, a little over a year later, after the full production at Sheridan College, David and Irene were selected to present a 45-minute version of Come From Away at the National Alliance for Musical Theater Showcase, a festival that is designed to connect musical writers with producers. Sue and Randy, in addition to their producing partners, Kenny and Marlene Olideff, were in the audience for the presentation, and they loved it.
Literally, when it was over, Kenny like ran up the aisle and basically accosted David and Irene and said, "We want to do this show. We want to do this show." He was the first person.
I'm always curious about what happens at this moment. How does "I want to produce your show" develop into "I'm now producing your show"? Especially in a case like this, where, as Sue remembers it, a lot of producers had been interested after that showcase performance.
David and Irene are very thorough, very meticulous people. And every single person who reached out to them, they reached back out and had a conversation with. So they were really, really careful and really methodical about that process. And we just, you know, we had a couple of meetings where we talked about our feelings about the piece and heard what they, you know, believed were next steps. And I think what happened over the course of those conversations is we all realized we were all pretty much on the same page about what we wanted.
We were all agreeing on
that. And as producers, that's really critical. You can't move forward with a piece if you want something different than the writers want.
The next step was to find a director. And coincidentally, there was one that was already interested. Remember the National Alliance for Musical Theater Showcase, NAMPT for short, where the Junkyard Dog team saw Come From Away and decided they wanted to produce it? Well, a woman by the name of Donna Harrell, the producing director for La Jolla Playhouse, was a reader for the festival, a reader being one of the judges who decides which musicals get presented at the festival. When she read Come From Away, she not only loved it and knew it needed to be part of the festival, she also knew that her boss at La Jolla Playhouse, the artistic director Christopher Ashley, would love it too. Here's Christopher.
She came into my office. She put the script down on my desk and said, I'm not leaving your office until you read this and love it, because it's right for the Playhouse and it's right for you. And she was right. And I had some demo songs and I put them in infinite loop in my car. So I spent about 3 weeks memorizing them all.
In what can only be described as Broadway kismet, Christopher had a relationship with the Junkyard Dog producers. He directed the Tony Award-winning musical Memphis for them in 2009 and had overseen the pre-Broadway production of Dr. Zhivago as artistic director at La Jolla Playhouse, where the show did its out-of-town tryout. So when Chris reached out to the producers to let them know that he was interested in directing the show and premiering it at La Jolla Playhouse, the producers agreed that it would be a perfect fit. However, the producers and Chris Ashley felt that there were a few important steps that needed to be taken before the La Jolla production could be mounted. First, Chris wanted to go to Gander with the producers and the writers to see the place he'd been charged with bringing to life on stage.
How was that? Amazing. I mean, the people are as generous when you go for research as they were in the story, just incredibly kind and feeding you all the time. I think I gained 5 pounds. Also great storytellers. They're kind of funny and emotionally available and masterful at being telling the sort of scope and scale of that story at the same time as seeming so offhand and humble. It's they're an amazing group.
Did they have a sense at that time that the story, from the other people I've met so far in the creative team and the cast, they're like, so hey, you're making a musical about people making breakfast for you? Like, yeah. Is that where they were coming from still?
A little bit. I mean, I think that they were bemused that I was up there, that David and Irene had come back, and they kept asking me, well, when does shooting start? Do you know what I mean? Like, the whole idea of, like, a musical based on this, just until they saw it, they didn't know what that could be.
Next, the creative team put up a workshop of the piece in Seattle, using local Seattle actors. Since they'd only ever actually seen the production at the NAMPT Showcase, a showcase that is basically done just at music stands, they wanted to see a staged version of it to make sure that it would work as a full production. They loved what they saw, and what resulted was a joint production, or partnership, between La Jolla Playhouse and the Seattle Repertory Theater, meaning that the show would premiere in La Jolla and then play Seattle a few months later. When the creative team began casting for the La Jolla production, they knew that their show was going to be an ensemble piece, meaning that there would be a small number of actors who'd be playing multiple roles. So they were looking for versatility.
I think that the auditions were somewhat hair-raising for people because I really cared that they were transformative and uncareful in a certain way. Like, I didn't want people who approached a bold choice fearfully. So we would give them some scenes in auditions to prepare. But then in the room, I would say, do it like an Eastern European. You know, I want you to be a Texas mom. I would throw kind of unexpected things at them. And the people we ended up with were all the people who kind of loved that and embraced that. People who were really adventurous and supple and capable of finding bold choices that weren't necessarily their home base.
Chris says that because the actors would be playing so many different real-life people, it was imperative that they look beyond physical appearance when casting. Here's Chris and then actor Cesar Samayoa.
We early on decided we're not trying to impersonate anybody. We're not trying to line up age, often race, looks at all. We're really trying to get at something that is the core of the spirit of those line of roles. You know, it's been interesting for Cesar, who plays both Kevin J, who's in a relationship with another Kevin that's kind of crashing and burning during the course of this, and also an Egyptian Muslim man, right? And like, who's got both of those things in them?
When I first went in, I read for every male role in the show. I think from the start, I just felt like, especially the Kevin and the Ali characters were characters that I really connected with, and they were the first ones they had me read, which was, it's kind of surreal that this mm-hmm. is how it all turned out. And then Chris Ashley just worked with me on a good 8-9 sides, different characters, kept on, you know, he really took his time. It was kind of one of the most respectful audition rooms I've ever been in. And then a month later, I had another callback, and then I got cast to the show, and I did kind of cartwheels down the street.
Another major piece of casting that needed to happen was for the actress who would play Captain Beverly Bass and others. Captain Bass, who was 51 during the time in which the show takes place, continued to be a pivotal character in the show, and casting directors reached out to actress Jen Colella. The only thing was that nobody had told Jen that they didn't necessarily need an actress who was the age of the character.
Bernie Telsey's office called me in, and I didn't think I was right for it because they wanted me to learn the pilot song, but I... You know, there's that line about somehow I'm 51. Right. And I was like, well, I'm not anywhere near that, darling.
21!
Anytime I do a sound check or anything, I go, somehow I'm 31. Like, but I don't know, really. And so sometimes, you know, actors are called upon to audition for things that we don't think we're right for. But I just wanted to remind Chris Ashley and Bernie Telsey and all those people who I am and how I work. So I got called back, and I still wasn't certain. I thought maybe they wanted to see me against whomever it is they were really looking at. And I was like, oh, how lovely of them. I'll be happy to help out. And then it wasn't until that callback that I thought, oh, I could feel the energy in the room. Maybe they really are looking for me.
I don't need to tell you that Jen Colella got the part. With their company of actors in place, rehearsals for the La Jolla production of Come From Away began in the spring of 2015. One of the first obstacles the company encountered was how to incorporate movement into the show. Here's director Christopher Ashley. The Kelly he mentions here is choreographer Kelly Devine.
Well, when we were first casting for it, we really did not know quite how physical the show was going to be. That really developed through rehearsals. So we didn't actually dance them. We acted them, we sang them, but there was no dance call for the show. And we arrived there the first day, and Kelly put kind of a first dance number on them, and they couldn't do it at all. She went outside and cried, and then came back in and, you know, like started to craft it on them and their bodies. And I love the movement of the show. And it feels like real people moving, and it's often very theatrical, and often very abstract, but it's always rooted in something very detailed and natural in the world about what it's like to sit on a plane or be in a bus or kiss a fish.
I think what Chris is saying is that they were able to tailor the choreography or movement to serve his overall minimalistic vision for the show. That in addition to dancing, movement could be used in a way that allowed actors to move set pieces or do quick costume changes on stage. To accomplish this, they brought in set designer Beowulf Borat to help combine elements of the set design with the choreography. Here's producer Sue Frost, director Christopher Ashley, and then set designer Beowulf Borat.
We all knew that we had to find the vocabulary for movement. Right from the beginning, Chris said, I think it's chairs and tables and maybe a turntable. And that was it.
I think that one of the really hard things for them was because it's almost a bare stage for a lot of the show. You don't have the luxury of like, a new set will come on and I go and sit in the couch. You've got to create the new set. You've got to know which spike marks the chair is supposed to go to. And then you've got to convince yourself and everybody else that that chair is actually a bus seat and not a wooden chair. You know, like the effort of imagination and also the unbelievably large number of configurations and spike marks and specific set moves they have to hold in their head.
Yeah.
It was really challenging.
Chris came to me right away and he said, we're trying to do the show with just 12 chairs and see if we can make 12 chairs be an airplane and be a bus and be all these different things. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons they came to me. I essentially did that for Scottsboro Boys. So I think they thought, oh, he's the chair guy. So they knew that wouldn't scare me off. And we knew from the beginning is because it was a cast, small cast playing multiple characters, it was going to be theatrical. They were going to be changing from one person to the next, essentially without costume changes. There wasn't going to be any attempt for you to think that Rodney Hicks is not the same actor playing four different people or Jen Colella isn't the same actress playing four different people, so on. So the set couldn't get too real in a way. If I started doing a bunch of realistic things, it would just feel at odds with the actors who were being so transformational.
Each actor I spoke to for this episode talked so glowingly about this process of figuring out how to tell this story. There was a lot of trial and error, and every idea, be it from an actor or a member of the creative team, was heard. The collaborative nature Chris Ashley and the rest of the creative team fostered in this way did two significant things. First, it brought the actors even deeper into the world of the show because they were helping to build that world. It also brought the company of 12 so close together that they became like family, which was not only a unique artistic experience for them, but also helped them to deal with building a show around the dark subject matter of 9/11 and to bring real compassion and love for each other to their work. Here's Cesar Samayoa, Jen Colella, and then Astrid Van Wieren, who plays Beulah and others.
This was such a collaborative process, and everyone's input was respected. It was so collaborative that we were able to help each other in different moments. I remember those first couple of days trying to figure out how to stage this. We would take about 2 days to stage, 10, 15 minutes mm-hmm. of the show. It's that intricate. Everybody's opinion was respected. It was such a cool way to develop a show. The rehearsal process for this was so special.
I trust those other 11 members so implicitly. And it's cool, switching in and out of characters with one another on stage. I'll look at somebody that I've just looked at 2 seconds before and their eyes have changed. Like we look at each other through different eyes with each character, and it's thrilling to watch how good everyone else is on stage with me.
Well, La Jolla was just a beautiful experience on every level. I mean, we were all our best and happiest, shiniest selves, I think. And then you're delving into this piece which has so much heart and humor, but you're all going back to that 9/11 place, and that's hard. So I think that made us immediately vulnerable with each other. And I think we all kind of collectively, unspokenly decided that that's what we needed.
One of the things I've learned about myself over the course of making these episodes is that I'm a little bit of a nerd for the scenic design. The set for Come From Away is especially interesting to me because it's basically static. As we've mentioned, actors bring set pieces on and off, but as an audience member, when you walk into the theater, you see a gorgeous, basically bare stage, dotted with trees and a blue backdrop that doesn't really change. And I was fascinated to hear set designer Beowulf Borat explain that what the set is doing is at once representing the barrenness of Newfoundland and also subtly conjuring images of the destruction and violence the show is set against.
The show is set in Newfoundland, so there wasn't the onus of putting New York on stage, but the events in New York and Washington on that day are the background for everything that's happening in the play. But there are a lot of references to trees and sort of the barrenness and the emptiness of Newfoundland. And what I kept thinking was that was interesting to me, that you've got a bunch of people telling a story about this urban destructive event sitting in this pastoral, rural environment. And there's a tension there that's interesting and dramatic. Early on, I kept saying, I really want to do trees, and I want them to be real trees. I don't want to do fake theater trees, even though they can be done very well. We wrestled a lot with how to sort of touch on the destructive quality of what happened. And in the end, I landed on this idea of just some broken trees. There's one of the famous pictures from the pile is these three big I-beams kind of sticking out at odd angles that it always struck me as kind of beautiful and horrible. And so I had done three trees that kind of looked that way. Eventually, it turned into just two trees, which has, I think, an even more obvious significance, these two broken, sheared-off trees. There's a sense of violence and destruction to them, and they just kind of stand there, kind of center stage, and exist as part of the image. And either people get it and it resonates, or they don't, and either one is okay. The other idea I played with early on, one of the images that really sticks with me from September 11th, I was in New York that day, and I think everybody who was here remembers the sky that day. It was this incredible cerulean blue. It was just like the perfect, beautiful fall day. And I wanted to somehow bring that back as well. So the set was almost always going to be painted this kind of blue color with clouds in it to sort of evoke the feeling of that day.
Come From Away was to open at La Jolla Playhouse on June 15th, 2015, and the producers had something very special planned. They had invited as many real-life people who were characters in the show as they could get in touch with to attend the performance. One of the first people the producers reached out to with an invitation was Captain Beverly Bass.
I mean, they said, remember that young couple that you did the interview with in Gander? And I was like, yes. And they said, well, they have written a musical and it's opening in La Jolla. We'd like to invite you. We just couldn't believe it. We could not believe it. We had no idea what we were in for.
What Captain Bass means there is that at the time she got the phone call and accepted the invitation to the performance in La Jolla, she didn't know, had no way of knowing, that writers Irene Sankoff and David Hein had become sort of obsessed with her story and had made her one of the central characters in the show. Captain Beverly Bass, they had learned, was a pioneer for women in aviation. Here are the bullet points. Beverly was obsessed with airplanes and flying from as far back as she can remember. Her mother would tell her later in life that even as a baby in a stroller, she would squeal and reach with both hands for airplanes flying overhead. As a kid, she'd asked her father for flying lessons, but her father wouldn't allow it. When she turned 19, she took her first flying lesson, came home, and told her parents she'd fly for the rest of her life. At age 21, she got her first paying job as a pilot, flying bodies for a mortician. Her big break came in 1976 at the age of 24 when she applied for and won a position as a flight engineer with American Airlines. From there, she moved up to first officer and then in 1986 became the first female captain for American Airlines. Shortly thereafter, she was the first female to command an all-female flight crew. In 1994, when Boeing rolled out its 777, aka 777, the largest twin jet in the world, Captain Bass was the first woman in the world to captain one, and American Airlines chose her to be one of their first 777 instructors, where she was oftentimes training men, which, if you remember, is exactly what she was doing when her flight was diverted to Gander on 9/11. Here's Come From Away writers David and Irene.
It was just like, it was such an incredible thing. We were ready to tell Beverly Bass the musical.
And honestly, that was my other point of, wait a second. This should be a musical about Beverly Bass. Yeah.
So they didn't do that, though they haven't ruled out that idea for the future. But what they did do was write a song that told her entire life story. It's one of only two solos in the show. Okay, so this is one of my favorite stories I heard over the course of making this episode. It happens just after the final preview in La Jolla. There was a party, a sort of meet and greet for the cast and creative team and the real life people who were characters in Come From Away who'd be seeing the show the following night for opening. You'll hear from Captain Bass, actress Jen Colella, who plays Captain Bass in the show, and the writers Irene Sankoff and David Hein.
Well, the first thing that happened is one day I opened up my computer and I saw a picture of Jen sitting in a chair in my uniform, but I thought it was me. I looked at the picture and I was like, why is my picture on Facebook? And then I went, whoa, wait, that's not me. It's Jen Colella. She must be playing my role in the musical.
after our last preview in La Jolla, we went to this restaurant called James's just across the street from the La Jolla Playhouse, and she was in there, and I spotted her from across the room just as she saw me.
And I saw her way across the room, and of course I now recognized her because I saw that picture on Facebook. And I said to my daughter, I said, "Paige, I think that's the gal who's playing my role." And so we both walked over to her.
And we made our way to each other.
And I said, "I think you're playing me. I'm Beverly Bass."
And she said, "I think you're playing me." And I said, "I think you're right."
And she said, "You don't say. I think you're right."
And she came to this party and she started telling us stories from that time because we were just chatting. And she was saying words that were verbatim from the show.
And you have to understand, I don't know one thing about the show. Not one thing. I don't know how prominent I am in the show. I don't know about the song Me in the Sky. I don't know anything.
And everyone was like, "Oh, you put a map on the wall and put pins. That's interesting." And we didn't want to say we didn't know what to say.
She started to tell me things about her story and was like, "This is my husband, Tom," and, you know, telling me about having the passengers on the plane for over 28 hours. And I was like, "You don't say. I mean, we have a song called 28 Hours. She'll find that out tomorrow." I was like, "You're going to like it." And then she's mentioning to me, you know, things from her, from the solo that's actually almost verbatim from the transcript of her interviews.
The next night, opening night, Beverly was there with her husband, Tom. The show started and was moving along beautifully. And then it came time for Jen to take center stage and begin the song Me and the Sky.
My parents must have thought they had a crazy kid, 'cause I was one of those kids who always knew what I wanted. They took me down to the airport to see all the planes depart, and watching them fly, something inside of me was starting. I was 8 when I told them that I'd be a pilot. But I was too young and too short, and there were no female captains. And my dad said, "Be patient," he said, "just see what happens." But I took my first lesson, came down from the sky, and told my father I'd fly for the rest of my life. And I got my first job flying for a mortician. You know, it's the only kind of real big solo in the show, and so I feel nervous, and it's coming off of this great group number screech, and it's so fun and so much energy, and then all of a sudden it's just like me, pin spot, sitting chill at a table, and so I get nervous. I wanna honor her, and I wanna honor my company.
I am suddenly alive.
First night was very challenging. We were front and center, maybe second row back. Well, my husband just buried his head in his hands. He and I are both just sobbing, and she can see us. I don't know how she did it. I do not know how she sang the song that night.
But I kept getting hired, and the World War II crew, they retired, and the girls all female American captain in history. Suddenly I'm in the cockpit. Suddenly I've got my wings. Suddenly all of those pilots protesting me, well, they can get their own drinks. Suddenly there's no one saying stay grounded. You know you're not in it. almost died. Suddenly there's something in between me and the sky.
Oh, I absolutely was surprised. I'm so honored by the way that she portrays me, because it is so perfectly done. And it makes me so proud to watch the show every single time I see it.
Come From Away opened at the La Jolla Playhouse on June 15th, 2015, to stellar reviews. Bob Verini and Variety said, in only their second attempt at a musical, Sankoff and Hine maintain a hard-edged reality that old pros would envy, staking out a solid throughline from their compiled anecdotes. Characters are types, but never stereotypes. James Herbert of the San Diego Tribune called the show an inspired and highly original piece whose structure is wed beautifully to its story. And in the LA Times, notoriously tough theater critic Charles McNulty said the show was directed with invigorating verve by Christopher Ashley. He praised the music and the cast, saying it was a true ensemble effort, with no one character or singer allowed to dominate. Although there is a lot of veteran talent on hand, the production is refreshingly star-free. It wasn't until the show opened in La Jolla that the producers were really sure that Come From Away could make it to Broadway. Here's Randy Adams and then Sue Frost.
To be honest, we didn't know if it was a Broadway show. We knew we loved it. We knew we wanted to be part of it, and we thought it would have a huge life, whatever that was going to be. But we weren't sure it's a Broadway show.
Yeah, tricky title, tricky subject matter, ensemble piece. You know, none of that screams Broadway, you know? And it wasn't until La Jolla when we first got the show up in front of an audience and we saw the immediate electric response that we said, you know what? This probably can go to Broadway. With all of those challenges, what it does is it connects with an audience like nothing I've ever seen.
Knowing that the show would benefit from a few more out-of-town runs, they charted a path. They first went to Seattle, where they broke box office records at the Seattle Repertory Theater. The next stop was the famed Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. Playing D.C. gave the cast and creative team the opportunity to present their show for the first time in a city that had been directly affected by the September 11th attacks and to meet some of the survivors there. The reviews in both Seattle and D.C. were excellent, and buzz about a Broadway transfer continued to build. Since the show takes place in Canada, the writers and producers felt Toronto should be the show's last stop before New York, and a November 2016 opening was set for Royal Alexandra Theatre. But before the show opened in Toronto, the producers received a unique invitation from Gander Mayor Claude Elliott, who'd seen the show in Seattle. Here's Mayor Claude Elliott, producer Sue Frost, and then actors Cesar Samayoa and Astrid Van Wieren.
I said, you've got to try to bring this to Gander so the people of Gander and the people of Newfoundland can have a chance to see it. Because I don't think that the majority of the people will ever get the chance to see it, you know, on Broadway or somewhere. But you need to bring it to Gander where it all happened.
And we said, well, that's all we need. If they're going to open those doors, then let's do it. And so we've identified a date that he could put a hold on the hockey rink. and it all made sense because between D.C. and Toronto, we had a 2-week break where we restaged it for a concert version. And everybody went to Gander and did 2 benefit concerts at the hockey rink.
People keep talking about Broadway, and we keep saying, yeah, Broadway's nice, but we're going to Gander.
I can't believe to this day how a bowl of soup and a sandwich and a blanket could turn into what it's turned in 16 years later.
It became a rock concert because all of a sudden you'd hear the mayor, Claude, who's also in the audience,
yes. And the whole audience would go
crazy. They would just go crazy. I feel like we needed their okay in order to go forward.
Yep.
And we definitely got it.
I think it was Lee, who plays Nick, Lee McDougall, who's a fellow Canadian, who said, okay, now, you know, we're not going to all cry. We've got to be professionals and stuff, because somebody had offered him Kleenex. He said, we don't need that. Of course, I think he was the first one bawling. I mean, the fact that, you know, you have almost 3,000 people out there in this big hockey rink, they're seeing themselves on stage, they're loving it. It was not a career highlight as much as a life highlight.
After the concert in Gander, Come From Away had a very successful run in Toronto before moving into the Gerald Schoenfeld Theatre on Broadway in one of the most crowded Broadway seasons in memory. The 2016-2017 season saw 13 new musicals open on Broadway. But in his review for the New York Times upon the show's opening on March 17, 2017, Ben Brantley not only assured that the show wouldn't be overlooked, but that it would also be a major contender when the Tony Awards rolled around. "Try if you must," he wrote, "to resist the gale of goodwill that blows out of Come From Away, the big bear hug of a musical that opened Monday night at the Gerald Schoenfeld Theater. But even the most stalwart cynics may have trouble staying dry-eyed during this portrait of heroic hospitality under extraordinary pressure." He went on, "This Canadian-born production is as honorable in its intentions as it is forthright in its sentimentality, and may provide just the catharsis you need in an American moment notorious for dishonorable and divisive behavior." Woo! Goodness, Brantley. When the Tony Award nominations were announced, Come From Away received 7, including Best Book of a Musical and Best Score for Irene Sankoff and David Hein, Best Featured Actress in a Musical for Jen Colella, Best Choreography for Kelly Devine, Best Director of a Musical for Christopher Ashley, and Best New Musical. In that very crowded season, Come From Away took home 1 award on Tony Night, Best Director of a Musical for Christopher Ashley.
I'd like to accept this on behalf of the people of Newfoundland and all of the first responders, the people who extended their hearts and their homes and were generous and kind at the very worst moments.
Come From Away is an undisputed Broadway hit. Not only is it a fan favorite, but commercially it recouped its $12 million investment in less than a year, announced a national tour and a Canadian production to play Winnipeg and Toronto. And just last month, it was announced that Come From Away will be made into a feature film to be directed by the show's now Tony-winning director, Christopher Ashley. I want to end this episode first with a story, then with a statement. The story comes from set designer Beowulf Borrett. For that one, just remember that the trees used for the set of the show are live trees. And then the statement comes from writers Irene Sankoff and David Hein.
But one of the fun and unexpected tree stories in the show is I said we added a few trees when we came to Broadway. So we went back to our guy in the woods and got 4 more trees last January while we were loading in Broadway. And entirely unexpectedly, in late March, the trees started sprouting leaves. And I got a picture from the show one day that there were leaves growing on the trees. And, you know, what it is trees go dormant in the winter. They've stored up this water. It's inside them. But they stop growing essentially over the winter, but they're still alive. And so the tree didn't know it had been cut down. And a number of them started sprouting leaves. And it was this kind of beautiful little symbol of the sort of sense of the renewal of life and the tenacity of life that the show is about. The sense of, you know, life having these deep roots that cling to the earth. And even though this awful, violent thing happens, you know, life is strong and it lasts.
It's been such a, I mean, writing it, we took all of these people saying things in the past tense and we changed them all to be present tense. And it's been such a present tense journey for us. Beyond that, we're just ecstatic that the people of Newfoundland are being celebrated by the people of New York. It's two islands. And I was thinking about it today and how New York taught us about kindness in response to a tragedy 10 years before Newfoundland taught us about kindness in response to a tragedy, and reminded that that was possible. And it should be possible every day. It shouldn't have to be in response to a tragedy, and that's what's so good about living in this story right now is you know, in the face of everything that's happening, we get to tell a story about people being good to one another, and it's a joy every day.
Welcome to the trees, a kiss and a card and whatever's in between. To the ones who've left, you're never truly gone. A candle's in the window and the kettle's always on. To the colds and the caves and the people from the plains.
5 days,
19 animals,
and 7,000 strays.
When the sun is setting and it's darker than before, if you're open for a harbor, then you'll find an open door. In the winter, from the water, from whatever's in the way, to the ones who have come from away, we say, welcome to the, 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 welcome to the rock.
Stay tuned after the credits for scenes from our next episode.
Now there's a solemn old tradition for admission or audition to transition from a come from away
to be a Newfoundlander.
The only other way, at any rate.
Discover the best theater in your city with TodayTix, providing insider access and exclusive offers in just a few taps. From front row seats to serious discounts, we've got you covered. We're available in 11 cities, including New York, London, Chicago, San Francisco, and Toronto. So download the app, that's Today, T-I-X, or visit todaytix.com to see what's playing this month and treat yourself to a show. And don't forget to use the code BACKSTORY to save $15 on your first purchase. Broadway Backstory is a partnership between TodayTix and Theater People Podcast. Episodes are produced and edited by me, Patrick Hines. You can follow me on Twitter, @PatrickHines. Special thanks for the production help from Steve Tipton, Mike Jensen, Matt Tamanini, Max Sadaka, Grace Fromm, and Ricky Kondos. Next time, on the season finale of Broadway Backstory, we tackle the 2013 Tony Award-winning musical Kinky Boots.
Well, I actually was on the board of Sundance for many years, and one of the years that I was in Park City going to see the films, I saw an evening performance of what seemed interesting to me, the title itself, Kinky Boots. I said, gee, that sounds curious. I'm going to go sign up for that film. And I did, and I saw the film, and as I was sitting there, I kept thinking to myself, this would make such a magnificent musical.
You know, we both decided that Jerry Mitchell was the perfect person to direct it. And Jerry then said the person to write this is Harvey Fierstein.
The film is wonderful. I didn't want to do a version of the film, but you don't want to throw out what's good.
You know, the hardest thing was Charlie for me, because Charlie never really grows a spine. And also finding the style of music that was Charlie's jam.
I remember at the end of that song, I would be standing at the top of the ladder and I would sing, I come to the rescue, on, I'd, you know, shove the boot in the air to like golf clap applause. People were like.
A lot of the creative people were really, really interested in exploring this idea that Lola was not gay. I was not interested in that at all. As a gay man, that was a problem for me. It was like, it's irresponsible, and it's a lie. And why would I do that?
That's next time on Broadway Backstory.